So we got 9 of the country's top healthcare leaders from all sorts of different states and cities and corners of the vaccination effort together on a Zoom call to talk about this unprecedented distribution that's going on.
It looks like you've got your Zoom shot all nice and set up, Dr. Elnahal. So
yes, after much feedback over the last several months.
And what I learned is that, you know, while supply is definitely the pressure point right now,
even now, you know, everyone's complaining we don't have enough vaccines, but you kind of have to do what you can to keep going.
Demand is the sort of simmering problem that they're all waiting for.
And when you say demand, you mean like getting enough people to take the vaccine.
Exactly. So right now we have people clamoring to get them and only a few million going out and being administered each day, each week.
It was right after we got 500,000 doses that we made the decision to open up to 65 and older. And then all of a sudden doses disappeared in Tiberias. Right before week 3, our allocations went to zero.
We're soon going to be flush with vaccines. I know that's hard to believe, but it will happen. We have hundreds of millions coming in the next few months. But then it becomes a problem of people who are skeptical of vaccination efforts, people who are hard to reach, who aren't part of the healthcare system, who are distrustful of the healthcare system.
They might not want it because they really think they're being followed by a chip in their shoulder. I mean, one of my own staff in my previous clinic did not want it because she thinks it is being tracked by a chip.
Those are going to be the last few people that we're really going to have thoughtful outreach plans for. And what goes into demand is going to increasingly have to do with racial and economic equity issues.
I'm Jeremy Siegel. This is Politico Dispatch. And today, Sarah Overmall on what she learned from conversations with 9 state and local health officials about how we can actually get everyone vaccinated. So, Sarah, who are all the health officials you talk to?
I'll go alphabetical on their names. Ayn Amjad, a commissioner and state health officer for West Virginia. She was great to have because West Virginia managed to vaccinate all of its nursing home population in 2 weeks before some states even started on that very high priority group.
We don't always have the manpower, the epi teams. No one wants to come to West Virginia. The pay is low. We lack resources sometimes, but you make do with what you have.
And then we also had Rachel Banks, director of the Public Health Division in Oregon, and she really acknowledged how in the effort to be efficient early on, they maybe weren't as equitable and how they're trying to work on that now.
So we were getting what some folks would say to the end of our 1A population, and huge groups of people weren't vaccinated. So we had to do really intentional planning and build that into the structure.
We had Dave Choksi, health commissioner of the city of New York, who had similar concerns to Rachel. Sharif Elnahal, president and CEO of the University Hospital of Newark in New Jersey, which deals with some of the same issues that New York City does, being a very highly populated and diverse city.
There was never going to be enough vaccine available for all sorts of categories that states are allowing right now.
We had Greg Holzman, state medical officer of Montana.
I do like to put it into perspective. January 21st last year was the first time a case was known in the United States, and that we have vaccines now. I can't tell you that every single day I am frustrated, my hair is getting grayer, but I always have to stop and look back and think about, wow, we actually have done a lot and a lot.
We had Jared Moskowitz, director of the Division of Emergency Management in Florida. They have also dealt with some early equity issues, and he talked about how they figured out how to actually get into communities of color and underserved neighborhoods.
So what we've done here in the state of Florida is I've taken the technology out of it. We've partnered with faith-based institutions. We've done 50 locations with churches in the Haitian community, the Black community, Caribbean community, the Puerto Rican community, the Cuban community. And what we're finding is those are tremendously successful.
We had Marcus Plesha, chief medical officer of the Association of State and Territorial Health Officials. Then there was Angela Rasmussen, a virologist at Georgetown University Medical Center. And finally, we had Race Vora, the interim health officer for Fresno County in California, which was an interesting one because it does have a very rural mix there. And what he's been doing to talk to his community has also been really interesting.
That is a lot of people. That's sort of like bringing back memories of trying to talk to a bunch of people during Thanksgiving.
It felt like that. And also, man, does an hour go by fast when you have that many people talking about their experiences. But it was great. I learned so much from them.
You mentioned that from talking with all these people, one of your big takeaways is that the problem's going to shift from not enough vaccines to not enough people who want them. Do you think that's actually a near future we might be looking at here, like where things are totally reversed and we have a bunch of vaccines and no one who's willing to take them?
Yes, I do. I actually think that that is a possible scenario, because if you think about it, just the two manufacturers that are already authorized, the Pfizer and the Moderna vaccine, have each promised to supply 300 million doses to the U.S. So that's enough for the vast majority of Americans. Then we've got a few more coming down the pipeline. Johnson & Johnson is going to be up for FDA review this month. They could be authorized very soon. We could have very feasibly have piles of vaccines and people who don't want them. I don't think that will be right away. I think in March and April, we'll still be in the same environment where you and I and average people will be saying, hey, when can I get mine? But then as you start to get more of the population, it's kind of like that final stretch where we're going to see that we aren't getting people, where maybe we get to 80% and we just can't break 80%. I could see that happening.
How much of a problem could that really be? Like, if you're someone who's thinking about all of this from a super individual or super personal perspective, and you're vaccinated along with, say, 80% of the population, but 20% of the population doesn't want to be, why should you care? Like, is that a problem for you at the end of the day?
Well, if we get to 80%, we are in a very good position in terms of immunizing people that are vulnerable. The only problem is that with these variants, we are learning that the coronavirus can be very adaptable, and that we might realistically need more shots in the future. You and I could get the shot and still need a booster later on. And these variants adapt and grow by being spread. And so if 20% of the population isn't getting the vaccine, they could still be passing around these variants that continue to evolve and make it harder for the people who already did get vaccinated to stay protected. That is one concern. Also, the concern there always is with vaccine hesitancy, whether coronavirus or not, is that if too many people say, well, everybody else is getting it, then there's just too big of a hole. We have to have a sense of, you know, personal responsibility. And that's something that happens a lot. You see that in small clusters when, say, there are communities in California that don't vaccinate their children against mumps, and then a certain amount of children are not vaccinated because they assume the rest of the community is, and then there's a mumps outbreak. So I think those would be the major concerns, and that's why the final stretch is going to be really difficult. But these local and city leaders are already thinking about what those challenges are going to be, and they are hoping and saying, at least in those Zoom calls, that they hope the federal government is thinking that way too.
Have they seen anything that's worked so far to reach populations that might be more difficult?
Well, I would say that one thing that they acknowledged on the call is that they do need to bring it off the web to a certain extent, that they need to have offline conversations with community leaders, with people who don't have easy access to the internet, and with people who can't easily get to, say, like a max vaccination site.
Everybody went digital appointments or appointments via a 1-800 number. And what I'm finding in my state is that when you go digital, people will drive hours into a neighborhood if they can get that appointment. And that is what's happening. My largest site is in a neighborhood called Miami Gardens, the city of Miami Gardens. It's a minority city in Dade County. Over 100,000 people live in that city. And 95% of the people getting appointments there are white. They're not from Miami Gardens. And that site's doing over 1,000 shots a day.
So I think that one thing that they definitely have all agreed on is that community leaders really, really matter.
What I would say is that the folks who have built loyalty and trust in the community for decades need to be engaged.
And they've said that they've had a lot of good feedback from faith leaders and from community organizations, reverends like offering to get this live on Facebook to show their communities that this is safe and good. And that's going to matter a lot more than I think people realize. One of the people on the call, Marcus Plesha, was saying that endorsement from someone you trust is better than any sort of PSA on television.
What about where vaccinations are actually done? Like, I know the Biden administration is helping coordinate mass vaccination sites, places like football stadiums. Is that an effective way of making sure everybody gets a shot?
Well, that's the interesting thing that came up repeatedly in this conversation. Yes, mass vaccination sites can quickly vaccinate many, many people, but then it becomes a question of who are those people getting to those sites. Marcus Plesha, the chief medical officer of the Association of State and Territorial Health Agencies, said that this is a common problem when you prioritize efficiency because equity doesn't always follow.
Efficiency doesn't really generally lead to a lot of equity. It's kind of a first come, first serve, and we know who tends to do best in those situations. But that's, you know, if that's the way we want to go as a nation, that's fine. If it's not, then we're going to have to be a little more patient, that being equitable and really trying to be judicious and vaccinate some of the groups that it makes the most sense to get to first, I mean, that's going to be a little bit slower.
And so that's why we've seen, even in federal data, that white women are outpacing any other group of people for getting vaccines so far. It follows that if you are your own best advocate in these things, that people who don't have the same resources won't be able to get this vaccine at the same time as you. So I'd say actually mass vaccination sites have been the thing lately, but that all of these leaders we talked to on the call are looking at ways to move it to community sites, to trusted healthcare providers, and taking it kind of to where someone works, where someone lives, or the community network that they have, like, say, a church or a mosque or something like that.
Sarah Overmall, thanks so much for talking with me.
Yeah, thank you, as always.
Sarah reported this story as part of a new Politico series launching today called Recovery Lab, which highlights the smartest new ideas emerging across the country for combating the pandemic. You can find more on our website, politico.com, and in this episode's show notes. Also, today, President Biden is planning to nominate Chiquita Brooks-LaSure to helm the trillion-dollar agency in charge of Medicare and Medicaid. That's according to four sources familiar with the decision, which was first reported by The Washington Post. Brooks-LaSure is an Obama administration veteran who oversaw implementation of Obamacare. If she's confirmed, LaSure will play a leading role in crafting Biden's plans to expand on the health care law and unwind much of the Trump administration's efforts to minimize it. And a federal judge says that two of the most memorable participants in the January 6th insurrection at the U.S. Capitol should remain in jail while their trial is pending. In a ruling on Wednesday, U.S. District Court Judge Royce Lamberth said Eric Munchell, who notoriously hopped a guardrail in the Senate chamber while armed with a taser and zip ties, along with his mother, Lisa Eisenhardt, espoused ideas so dangerous and chilling that they can't be safely released into the community. Even though neither of them has an extensive criminal history or posed a serious flight risk, Lamberth leaned heavily on their statements to local media, embracing armed revolution and expressing willingness to commit violence and even die to stop the election results as proof they would be dangerous to others. Subscribe to Politico Dispatch wherever you get your podcasts. And while you're there, check out some of our other shows like Nerdcast, Politico Energy, Pulse Check, and the Playbook Audio Briefing. I'm Jeremy Siegel. Thanks for listening.